It's Friday, November 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, France mourns the victims of the Paris attacks. Its president vowing to defeat this army of fanatics, as he called ISIL, following the attacks. We speak with VOA's Daniel Scharf in Moscow. He has returned to his post there following an assignment in Paris. Pope Francis spreads his words of peace to Africa. This man has heard him.
Now, I feel that I should mind more about the poor, mind about the environment, and fight for peace.
And the music world recently lost a giant. Jim Stevenson has word of the passing of Alan Toussaint. Stay with us. It's all ahead. Welcome to International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. French President Francois Hollande vowed Friday to crush what he called the army of fanatics who carried out this month's deadly terror attacks in Paris. He was presiding over a national memorial service for the victims, which was held earlier today. The commemoration, held at the Invalides National Monument, began with a somber reading of the names and the ages of the 130 people who died in the attacks claimed by the Islamic State group. It's been a couple of weeks since the team of Islamic State militants swept through the capital city of France, setting off the suicide vest, opening fire on innocent victims in several locations, including a crowded concert hall. VOA's Daniel Scharf now joins us on International Edition. He has returned to his base in Moscow after being apart and joining VOA's reporting team in Paris. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us. This story obviously has so many facets to it. Let's start now with today's comments from the French president I just mentioned. He wants to crush the army of fanatics. Well, he's just come back from meeting with U.S. President Obama here in Washington, with British leader Cameron in London, and to Moscow, where you are now with the Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Did anything take place that you have heard of in those meetings that might lead Hollande to believe that that goal of defeating this army of fanatics could really take place?
Well, we did see some steps forward coming out of the meeting between Hollande and Putin. There was agreement to better share information, intelligence that they received regarding terrorism and also the situation in Syria directly. They actually discussed and agreed on trying to better coordinate airstrikes against terrorist targets. Probably most significantly, they agreed that they would try to identify which targets are actually Islamic State and other terrorist groups, jihadists and so forth, that pose a real threat. That's been a big sticking point between President Putin and the U.S.-led anti-Islamic State coalition. Putin has been saying that they've been targeting terrorists and Islamic State all along, but in the early days of the bombing that started in late September, the Russians were pretty clearly hitting everybody who was against President Assad in Syria. So the fact that he was able to get Putin to say, at least on the record, that he agreed to better target the real terrorists is a good thing. Whether or not that actually happens, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, the almost, I guess you could call it, the elephant in the room here is support or non-support for the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Where does that stand, you think?
Well, you know, Russia and President Putin have made statements in the past that they're not seeing him as the embodiment of Syria. That they've implied that you know, he doesn't need to be the leader of Syria necessarily. But at the same time, Russia's military actions in support of President Assad very clearly is going to shore up his rule. And President Assad has said that he is not going to be allowing any kind of a political process to take place until Islamic State has been eliminated. So we have a bit of a contradiction there, and it's not really clear if President Putin is willing to give way on trying to come to some sort of a real transition that would get Assad out of power and allow for a political process. But we have seen also a little bit of wiggle room on the Western side. They've no longer said that Assad has to leave first before there can be any kind of political solution. So there is some room for negotiation there. It's just whether or not the two sides can really sit down and come to some sort of a real deal on this issue.
Well, what seems to be the mood in Moscow on this? Does there seem to be room for movement?
Well, you know, we get different messages coming out of the Kremlin, but right now it seems like they're kind of hardening their stance when it comes to their support of President Assad. We did see some pretty strong statements concerning ground forces having to be used to in order to really eliminate the terrorist threat in Syria, and those ground forces having to be the Syrian army, which is under President Assad. That's what the Russians are saying. So certainly there is more support being voiced in recent days. Now, part of that might be because of this whole fight over the Russian bomber that was shot down by the Turkish F-16. That certainly has hardened positions here in the Kremlin and also in Ankara, and could be creating some more obstacles to coming to a real negotiation that could see the Syrian peace process move forward.
Now, where does that stand? Earlier today, the Turkish President Erdogan said that he was hoping he'd be able to meet with Mr. Putin in Paris within the next week or so. That's been shot down, I take it, already, right?
Well, the Russians are not saying whether they're going to be up for that kind of a meeting. They did acknowledge that they received that invitation from the Turkish side, but they have not responded officially yet, at least publicly, as far as whether or not President Putin is willing to meet face-to-face with him. Obviously, there's a lot of bad blood between the two men right now. They've both made some extremely strong statements. President Putin accused Turkey of supporting terrorism, and you know, in Turkey, of course, they've also said some very strong things about Russia's you know, attacks inside Syria, and so it's hard to say whether or not President Putin is going to accept this slight olive branch that's been extended to try and mend over the bad relations because of this incident.
Well, Putin has been very popular among the people of Russia, as we have been told and as we have read. Does he have great support as far as the shooting down of a Russian Russian bomber is concerned among the people in Russia?
Well, inside Russia, you know, we have to keep in mind, of course, that the vast majority, almost all of the media here, certainly the broadcast media, is controlled by the Kremlin. So the propaganda message is very strong when they want it to be. And with the shooting down of this Russian bomber by the Turkish jet, it's been on overtime. We've been hearing extremely strong statements coming out of the media, just mimicking and playing off of and feeding off of all of the messages coming out of the Kremlin, that Turkey is supporting terrorism, that this was an unprovoked an attack that was planned by the Turkish side, that they were trying to create a provocation and create problems for complicating the situation further. So it's been very strong. And most people in Russia, they only have access to that kind of information. They don't have access to independent media. So when you're constantly bombarded with those messages that Russia is under attack, that everybody is against Russia, look what they've done to Russia again, they believe it. And it's not just Turkey, but of course, Turkey is a member of NATO, and Russia in the last few years has been really heavy with the propaganda that NATO is surrounding Russia, coming to get Russia, and we have to prepare to defend ourselves. So, yeah, for the most part, I mean, you could safely say that the vast majority of Russians support President Putin, especially when he acts tough against someone who is perceived to be attacking Russia.
What do you think Russia has in their plans as far as retaliation or retribution as far as Turkey is concerned?
Well, we're already starting to see some retaliation, and it came fairly quickly after Russia confirmed that their bomber had, in fact, been shot down by the Turks. And it started off with some very strong statements of discouraging tourists to go to Turkey, saying that it was no longer safe because Turkey, according to the Kremlin, was supporting terrorism, and so Russians could be targeted in Turkey. And then we saw some inspections that were taking place, stepped up against Turkish imports into Russia, food and, you know, produce and clothing and materials, this kind of thing. Suddenly the Kremlin's inspectors were finding all kinds of sanitation and safety issues. And this is a common tactic that they use when there's any kind of political or military conflict with one of their trips.
VOA's Daniel Scharf in Moscow. Daniel, thanks so much for being with us on International Edition.
My pleasure.
We continue with International Edition from Washington, D.C. as we check social media. Among the bigger stories, the U.S.-based outdoor gear store REI announced earlier this month that it would be closing this day, this Friday, called Black Friday after Thanksgiving. It is the biggest shopping day of the year in America. And REI, instead of bringing in its employees, urged its customers to go outside and enjoy nature instead, not wait in the long lines indoors to buy things. The announcement came as part of its hashtag Opt to Outside campaign on social media. That is one story. And another one that caught my eye about the drone dentist. Please don't try this at home. We're being told to tell you. Back in June, a guy named Paul Borods, his nephew Bruno, yes, Bruno Borod, asked him to help pull out a loose tooth. Now, instead of using the old doorknob and string method, they decided to use Borod's drone. 24 hours later, they were ready to complete their drone tooth pull. They tied some dental floss to Bruno's tooth. Then it was time for liftoff. Borod said in his video description that he double-checked with Bruno one last time before he started the drone. Drone took off. All went smoothly. Tooth came out easily. And I guess Bruno stayed on the ground. All smiles. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A number of scientists say that Earth's magnetic fields have been quickly losing strength over the past 100 years or so. Recent research suggests that because of this, Earth is on the verge of flipping its magnetic poles. But a new study finds that the field strength is merely returning to normal after reaching rather unusually high levels. Columbia University's Dennis Kent, the study's co-author, says that while Earth's magnetic field may be rapidly weakening, it's not lower than the long-term average. He also suggests that after weakening to a point, the fields may again increase in intensity. Earth's magnetic field has flipped a number of times throughout its 4.5 billion year history. The last time that happened, about 786,000 years ago, scientists said it took only about 100 years of diminishing field strength to do so. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America from VOA. I'm Ira Melman. On his final day in Nairobi Friday, Pope Francis visited a slum and condemned what he called the injustices of urban poverty and substandard living conditions. Placed the blame on all this and what he called a selfish minority clinging to power and health. VOA's Jill Craig was there. She has this report for us.
Speaking at the St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Parish in Nairobi's Kangemi slum, Pope Francis did not shy away from making his thoughts known on urban poverty.
Estoy aquí porque quiero que sepan que sus alegrías y esperanzas.
The Pope said he understands the difficulties the people face each day, as well as their hopes and sorrows. The crowd cheered as the Pope said that to deny a family water under any bureaucratic pretext whatsoever was a great injustice. He said lack of access to infrastructure and basic services is a serious problem. He included on this list toilets, trash collection, electricity, roads, schools, hospitals, sports centers, and even studios and workshops for artisans and craftsmen. The pontiff chastised what he called minorities who cling to power and wealth and selfishly squander. He said they force a growing majority to flee to substandard living quarters, even though God gave the earth to the whole human race without exclusion. Grace Jiroge attended the event and is glad the Pope highlighted the struggles of slum dwellers.
Because whatever Papa was saying is what has led Kenya to have so many slums because of this rat grabbing by private developers. And also you find that you cannot have access to water.
But Pope Francis also praised the poor, whom he said the language of exclusion often disregards. He said they are able to weave bonds of belonging and togetherness, which convert overcrowding into an experience of community. From Kangemi, Pope Francis headed to a rally with thousands of youth at a sports stadium. The crowd cheered as he arrived in his Pope-mobile. The Pope took questions from young people and spoke off script. He urged them to resist corruption, comparing it to sugar, saying that one may develop a taste for it, but ultimately it's destructive. He also called for an end to tribalism, an issue that continues to plague Kenya, and he advocated for education and jobs as a way to prevent young people from being radicalized. Morris Karimi says he plans to heed the Pope's messages from the last 2 days.
The way he gives his speeches and the messages is quite convincing. He'll have an influence on decision makers and even upon myself as an individual. I am feeling influenced. And now I feel that I should mind more about the poor, mind about the environment, and fight for peace.
The Pope left Kenya Friday to visit Uganda, the second country, on his inaugural Africa tour. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Heads of state and delegates from 196 countries are converging on Paris for the COP21 climate summit.
Well, we move from Africa to Europe and to Paris, but this does not have to do with an attack. Hopefully it will not. Heads of state and delegates from 196 countries are converging on Paris for the COP21 climate summit that begins Monday. They're trying to reach a binding agreement on reducing carbon dioxide gas emissions. As Henry Ridgewell reports, there is cautious optimism that some kind of deal can be reached.
Heads of state and delegates from 196 countries are converging on Paris for the COP21 climate summit, which begins Monday. They're trying to reach a binding agreement on reducing carbon dioxide gas emissions. As Henry Ridgewell reports, there is cautious optimism that a deal can be reached. 4,700 metres above sea level lies the Tibetan Plateau, known as the Roof of the World. Its glaciers are the source of many of Asia's most important rivers. But the ice is melting. Scientists say that if that continues at current levels, two-thirds of the plateau's glaciers will likely be gone by 2050, affecting up to 2 billion people in China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh and Bhutan. Li Yan is from Greenpeace China. She says glacial melting on the Tibetan Plateau should be a climate change alarm bell for global heads of state. Delegates at the Paris summit will attempt to reach a new binding agreement limiting emissions of carbon dioxide, which scientists say are driving temperatures upward. They will try to limit global warming to no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by the end of this century. Smita Nakuda of the Overseas Development Institute says that target is crucial.
Without that, we will begin to feel extremely severe impacts of climate change, such as extreme weather events, droughts, flooding, and other disruptions to our way of life.
Scientists say we are likely already starting to feel some of the impact of climate change. 2015 has been the hottest year ever recorded. There is evidence that warmer temperatures are making storms more intense. At the Copenhagen summit in 2009, developed nations agreed to provide $100 billion of public and private financing to help developing countries adapt to climate change. And
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. The music world recently lost a giant, Alan Toussaint. Died this month after a performance in Spain. You might not be familiar with the name, but you're very likely familiar with his music and the sounds he inspired. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald and Jim Stevenson remember Toussaint's deep influence on many music genres.
After I've said I'm sorry, we did experience a big loss, Jim. His name was Alan Toussaint. He was a singer, he was a songwriter, he was a producer, and he was a cultural ambassador for the city of New Orleans. He was born and raised there, and he was a major musical presence for six decades. He died on November 9th of an apparent heart attack just hours after performing in Madrid, Spain. He was 77.
How can we just end something that has been so much more good than bad?
Alan grew up in New Orleans. As a child, he learned to play piano in the syncopated style of Professor Longhair. And this was a distinctly New Orleans sound. And in the 1960s, he became a successful songwriter and producer in New Orleans. And some of his early hits include some pretty early rock classics like Mother-in-Law by Ernie K. Doe, Working in the Coal Mine by Lee Dorsey, the song Fortune Teller, which has been covered by many acts, including the Rolling Stones early in their career. And then in 1977, Glen Campbell had a number one hit in pop, country, and adult contemporary with a song of Alan's called Southern Nights.
Southern Nights. Have you ever felt a Southern Night?
He also recorded a series of solo albums in the 70s, although he said he was always more comfortable behind the scenes. He started working with artists outside the New Orleans orbit, which took his career to the next level. He arranged horns for the band. He worked with the group LaBelle. He produced their signature hit, Lady Marmalade.
Your Lady Marmalade.
He collaborated with Paul McCartney.
Alan Toussaint. We have lost a great musical legend in this town. That's our show. Visit our website at boanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. Thanks for being here.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hard on the heels of the terrorist attack in Paris, which resulted in the deaths of some 130 people, came a terrorist attack on a hotel in Bamako, the capital of Mali. Prior to 2012, Mali was one of Africa's longest established democracies, but a failure to deal with ethnic tensions in the north, as well as the presence of extremist groups operating from safe havens in the north, led to a Tuareg rebellion. This rebellion was then usurped by violent extremist elements, reinforced with arms and fighters from Libya. The country was destabilized, and this led to a military coup in 2012. Extremists with links to Al-Qaeda occupied large parts of northern Mali and began to institute their fundamentalist version of Sharia and brutalize the civilian population, forcing thousands to flee. The Malian government requested help. In 2012, a French military force backed by African partners from Chad and Niger under Operation Sabre disrupted and scattered extremist forces, which largely fled to Tunisia and Libya. However, remnants of the extremist group continue asymmetric attacks against the Malian government as well as the United Nations peacekeeping mission. The French continue counterterrorism operations against extremists. There is good reason to believe that terrorists chose their target specifically because the hotel is popular with foreigners and at the time of the attack was hosting a number of delegations attending peace talks. At least 22 people died, among them six Russians, three Chinese nationals, an Israeli, an American, two Belgians, one citizen of Senegal, and another from Lebanon. Many of the victims, including one American, were people who came to Bamako to help the Malian government and the Malian people through difficult times. These international efforts to restore peace, security, and prosperity in Mali will continue. The support of the U.S. government in these efforts will continue as well. The United States condemns in the strongest terms the terrorist attacks in Bamako. We extend our deep condolences to the families and loved ones of those who have been killed in this heinous attack, said U.S. National Security Council spokesman Ned Price. The United States stands with the people of Mali and will remain a steadfast partner along with other key allies and African partners fighting the terrorist groups that seek to undermine Mali's efforts to build durable peace and stability.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.